sound. People say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get?
Hello comrades, and welcome back to season 4, episode 6 of Spectre. I'm absolutely delighted to today to be joined by Matt Kerr. Matt, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Pleasure to be here, Nathan. Thanks for asking as well.
Perfect. So just to start off, Matt, just a wee introduction from yourself, you know, who you are, your affiliations and everything else in between.
I'm Matt Kerr. I suppose I primarily still describe myself as a CWU guy, but I started off as a postie in Silcoats, then Govan, and then was elected to Glasgow City Council to represent the Cardonald ward back in 2007, about 300 years ago. I'm still doing that, but I'm also now the Scotland correspondent for the Morning Star as well, which I've been doing, I think, for about two or so, maybe 3 years now. I'm not sure, I've lost count. About 2 or 3 years now, and I'm thoroughly enjoying that. So that's the general gist of it.
Oh, good.
A few other things, my own bones are
good, man, Matt. And I'll keep an eye for the listeners to make sure Matt doesn't accept any CBEs or OBEs anytime soon. Don't worry, he's a strong UCW member. But no, cheers, Matt, for coming on. And I've kind of been looking at doing some more episodes similar to this in terms of talking about some of you know, Scotland's most famed kind of socialist heroes and communists, etc. And having recently done some similar ones to it, I thought it was only fitting to talk about Mick McGahey. So I guess we're better to start off than actually looking at Mick McGahey, you know, who he was, his family legacy, which has played an important role to where he went in life,
yeah.
His early life that shaped him and everything else in between, if you can give us a wee kind of rundown on that.
Very, very brief rundown. I don't claim to be one of the greatest historians of him or anything like that. But he was a guy. He was born on the eve of the general strike. I think he was born 25, so he was just an infant when that occurred. His father had been a founding member of the Communist Party, I believe, but had also, as any good communist would be, active in the trade union movement, and was as a result blacklisted. And that, I guess that experience not only caused them to shift, like physically, geographically, to where they could find work, and he experienced that in his childhood, and the hardship that came with that. But I guess he probably, from a very, very early age, no doubt, as soon as he could listen and understand what was going on around him, I'm sure he picked this up from his father, what we were up against as working people. The challenges that you face day in, day out, not just to put the bread in the table, so to speak, but actually just to find the right to work itself. So that was obviously, you know, that was something that was clearly etched on him and etched into everything he did. He was a quite a remarkable man in many ways. I mean, I wrote about him recently in the Morning Star. And it's something I'm one of these people that I'm a bit wary of the kind of great man theory of history. I'm wary of that. But some people are exceptional. I think they're worth noting. I'll come back to that point in a little moment. But I think, you know, you look at him, he clearly somebody who, you know, picked up that kind of ethos, if you like, from his father. I think that's the obvious place to have got it. But he picked it up in the workplace, you know. He by the age of 18, he was the chair of his branch in the NUM. Now, right, you know, there's not many people who are at the age of 18 are chair of their branch these days. And fair play to them if they do it. I mean, you know, you've done no bad yourself, Nathan. You know, but you know, it's quite a big deal that. But if you think back to when that occurred. You know, if you think of when that happened, the NUM in particular, right, firstly, it was massive, right? So you had huge membership. But secondly, the level of working class education in there, and the level of, and because of that, the level of ability that had been they've been nurtured within that union and in those in that union's branches was quite remarkable. So for an 18-year-old to get to attain that position, I think says something about him. And it's something that came back later on in his later life. I mean, he was known for always paying a lot of attention to young trade unionists getting involved. And one of his big mantras was read, read, read. You know, educate yourself. Because that's how you give the good speech. Aye, very good. But it's how you understand your opponents. And it's how you understand your comrades as well, and how you understand the world. Because the world goes beyond the pit. It goes beyond the pit gate, and it goes far wider than that. And having that breadth of knowledge behind you makes all the difference in the world. I suppose people have the benefit of having all of this on their phones these days virtually, don't they? But the essence is still the same. Read, read, read. That's the thing. You know, get every bit of information in there you can. You read the people that might be ideologically aligned with yourself or whatever, but also read people that will challenge you. You know, if nothing else, to prepare yourself for the debates that lie ahead. You know, I think it's really a really important part of it. And he was. It's funny for a guy that was. Much maligned in the press, as you can probably imagine. You know, he was an intellectual. He was a worker. He was an intellectual. He was a fighter. He was an organizer, and he was an inspiration to generations of trade unions. And I think for those reasons, he's somebody who's worth remembering, and his example is worth following to some extent. I say nobody's perfect. I'm sure if we picked away, we could find something. But as far as I can see, he's been a great inspiration. I'll say one thing. The first time I heard his name, I was only a wee sprog myself. Right? It was probably during the miners' strike in 84, 85. Right? So I was only a wee thing. Like five. Right? So my grandfather worked in Cadown, which is theoretically where Mick had worked towards the end of his mining career. But of course, by that point, he's a national official. Realistically, he wasn't there very often by that stage. But I remember the kind of thing being said in the house. You know, if Mick had been running this strike, you know, we would have won it. You know, and that was being said even during it. You know, there was an issue. But there was already some issue. You know, and there were tensions between him and Scargill. And I don't think either of them were necessarily terrible people or anything like that, but there was clearly differences of tactical differences between them. We'll put it that way, maybe. I think it's an interesting counter narrative. You know, it's an interesting thought. You know, what would have happened if he'd led the thing? But we are where we are, as all the worst managers in the world say. What I think is he also said that he was a product. He described himself as a product of his class and of the movement, and I do think that's really important. Again, it's something I referred to in my wee article. Is that to jump back to that thing about the great men theory of history? You know. He didn't subscribe to either. You can admire people and you can be inspired by people. Absolutely. There's nothing, no harm in that at all. But he was a product of his class. He was a product of his movement and a movement he grew up to help lead. But he was a product of that something bigger than any one of us. And I suppose the example that we can draw from that is that's what we all are. We're all products of our class. We're all products of our experiences. And the question we must always ask ourselves, so what are we going to do with that? What are we going to do with those gifts? And they are gifts, by the way. They're not hindrances. They needn't be. You know, you should be proud to be working class. You should be proud of your experiences. The question is, what are we going to do with them to make the world a better place, throughout our lives? And for me, that's what I take out of it. That's what I take out of, you know, when I read about them. I think there's a guy who used his time, and he used his time really, really well to You know, I think it had a massive effect on Scottish society, not least, I'm sure, maybe come back to this in a minute, but in terms of the early moves to get a Scottish Parliament established. So, but there you go.
Yeah,
no, just... ramble, Nathan,
No, cheers for that, man. I think it kind of cements certainly mixed position, like you say, with that kind of quote he used. He's a product of his class, and yeah, looking at kind of years gone by and these former like mining towns and strongholds like Shotts and North Lanarkshire and that, you know, although there were like strong communities, a lot of the people who found themselves working within them were often described as, you know, like the gypsies of trade, because they were always moving with the collieries, moving with work. So it's this weird kind of like parallel you get. But certainly with Mick kind of highlighting, certainly within his life, obviously a product of his class in terms of just his general, you know, day-to-day struggle, but certainly the kind of relationship in that with his father. Highlight his father was always quite tough on him when he started work at 14. Hell of an age to be starting grafting. Certainly don't envy him there.
And that nation, you know, I was lucky enough to see my great-grandfather up in the Lanarkshire coalfields as well, in Auchengeer, actually, and then in Bedley. And he was down the pit at the age of 12. Now, he was lucky enough to live. I mean, he was buried alive three times, but he was lucky enough to live to retirement. And you know, and he actually died not long after the miners' strike. And but I often think, but he was one of the brightest people I've ever met. By the most educated people I've ever met, easily. I used to time himself doing the Herald crossword, you know. Don't even read the paper right enough. He didn't read the Star, but he was a but that was a that was an ethos within the NUM, within the mining communities. You educate yourself, because no other bugger's going to do it for you. Nobody's coming on high to save you. You know, working class have to fight for this and do it themselves. And that was something that was definitely there. I saw it in my great grandpa. I remember it very, very vividly well, and you know, I saw it in my grandpa as well. And that's where we met, you know. And I think there was that sense that, you know, we have to go on with it here. I think that's a really important thing.
Yeah. All right, we'll come on obviously to talk about some of the kind of stuff to do with the trade unions and, you know, what's before us today. But I certainly with Mick, when he goes on about like even his father like bringing him up in a certain manner and, you know, being quite critical of him, I think it's that kind of nature you still see today, is that, you know, dads of years gone by knew how tough it was then, preparing their sons for something quite similar. And certainly for Mick's case, it was, if he was going to follow in his dad's footsteps, being active and work, being active in the party, then he certainly had to, you know, be bolstered for it. And sure. Some of the kind of like writings on Mick McGaha here, like he says, the not wanting to dive into the great man theory, or what some people call, but certainly, you know, from so many accounts of people who wouldn't have identified themselves as being, you know, inherently communist or the borderline themselves with socialists, they always talk about how Mick, regardless of, you know, their stance and things, Mick was always helping them out with everything, young reps, shop stewards and everything who were stepping up in the NUM at the time. And he always prioritised his reps, his lay members, kind of above anything else, and trying to hit the message home to them. So no, I think that's a good kind of count. You've already touched on the kind of aspect of the NUM, Mick following in his dad's footsteps, from even just working in the mines to actually being active in the NUM, and no doubt the kind of differences he had with Scargill in terms of where power was being formulated in the union. You know, with Scargill, it was quite centralised. You see Mick's vision of having it devolved to the branches, especially. So just look to see if you can give us a kind of a breakdown of the NUM at that time, because it's quite an interesting piece. There's so much happening just in Scotland alone. You know, Bill McLean was one of the most popular figures that I say remember as if I was alive at the time, but remember from what I've seen in terms of oral history.
I was barely around myself, you know.
But, you know, Bill also hitting home that constant message that was so prevalent in the NUM as opposed to any other union at the time was political education, and the fact that the unions have to not just be involved in the workplaces but deal with issues, social issues, housing, and everything else as well. So just to see if you can give us a wee kind of breakdown of the situation with the NUM at that time, maybe with the strikes and how how Mick would have been progressing through to the position that he was at his highest.
Yeah. Well, I think the important thing to remember about the NUM historically is how NUM developed. It was not a single big lump of a union. You know, it grew out of dozens and dozens and dozens of smaller unions and lodges, actually, as they called themselves, and they gradually amalgamated. So it always had a history of a localism within it. And Mick was part of that history in some respect, and that's sort of what he brought forward. I mean, he wanted not. I don't think he believed in a breakaway, of course, you know, but he believed in some degree of local autonomy. And I think when it came in the run up to the Great Strike, if you like, there was clear tensions on that. And I mean, potential. I mean, you know, it depends on your point of view, I suppose. I can understand where Scargill was coming from, that he's like, you know, one singer, one song, this is how it has to be. I get that. But at the same time, I think Mick appreciated, and I think, to be honest with you, I'm with Mick on this, is that you have to take people with you. And there had to be some understanding and some flexibility locally. And actually, you know, if that had been maybe understood earlier in the strike, I think it might have developed slightly differently, particularly on this issue of ballots. You know, they were unified on this idea that, you know, we're not going to go down the ballot. The actual formal ballot route is obviously Thatcher was trying to shove down people's throats. Now, that's been portrayed, that's routinely portrayed to this day in mainstream media as, oh, you know, these people were anti-democratic. Far from it. It's quite the opposite. They understood, it was because they understood that these votes should be taken in workplace to workplace, branch to branch, and so on and so forth. And you should have the courage of your convictions to make to express your view and express your opinion in front of your comrades. Now, that's not that's not about intimidation. That's about actually people having the guts to stand up for themselves. So I see it's quite the opposite. I was in a workplace previously where we took a lot of wildcat action, and we decided to take wildcat action by lifting our hands. That's how we did it, and some people voted against. And some people, but they would still come out with this, right? And that was it. You know, you had your view. If you didn't, you win. Out you go, right? We stood together. I can only think of one exception where somebody decided to break the line. He didn't do it again, but that was the end of that. But there was a. I think there's something that is a very important point, and that is also a different sort of a principle point here, in that it's not for a government to decide to dictate to a trade union how it should organise itself. It's up to the workers, the members of it, not a government. And I think that's a really important point, because the trade union movement should not be... Trade union movement is, you know, back then was the beginnings of it. But our trade union movements are some of the most regulated in the world. You know, I mean, you know, arguably that they're far more regulated in terms of the finances than most financial institutions. You could probably argue in some ways. That's why I always get annoyed when people talk about union money in politics. It's the cleanest money in politics by a country mile. And you know, I say I've got off way off of that, but you know, I see you grimacing here, Nathan, as I go off on another tangent. But this all comes back to this point about understanding what a trade union is about. And this basic understanding, I see it, and I think Mick saw it, as about the workplace first and foremost, right? You organise, you democratise in your workplace, and everything else flows from there. The minute you get to the point where it flows the other way, and you get too much, I get why there has to be, obviously, at a national level, you need levels of coordination and policies at national level. But the minute there is a disconnect there, and people feel they are being dictated to in their branch or in their workplace, to any great extent, that's when you get difficulties. And actually, that if I'm honest with you, I think that played a part in what happened in Nottinghamshire, sir. Because you're not going to tell me every single person in Nottinghamshire was a scab, right? Well, you know, obviously, clearly, a lot of them were, You're not going to tell me every single one of them. I mean, what was wrong there? That was avoidable, I think, and that was a wound that people like Thatcher and the scabs that were already there were able to pick away at. And I think it was an avoidable wound, if you like. And I think if we'd taken more of a Mick type of a line, that split might not have occurred. Now that opening for the right wing and the kind of the infiltrators and the and we'll come to that in a minute, I think, as well. to try and kind of undermine the whole damn thing. So I do think a more localist, a greater understanding of local democracy within trade unions would have been important then, it's becoming just as important now. In fact, if not so more important, as trade unions unfortunately have shrunk. So because of that, the power of branches isn't what it used to be. I'm not sure that's how it should be. Some great examples of powerful local branches passing resolutions and doing some amazing things in the past. You think back to, you know, we lionised those engineers at Rolls Royce for blacking the engines going to, they were supposed to be repaired and go back to Chile. That was a result of a union branch decision, not the union nationally. Union branch passed a resolution in support of Chile, and so when that situation occurred, they knew what they must do. Now, how many union branches do you think could get away with that now? You see, this is the crux of it, and in a way, that's one of the successes of Thatcherism. They've actually, by shrinking the trade union, they've actually made it. You've weakened branches in the process, and you weak branches. You weaken branches, you weaken the political education and the political influence in those branches, and that has effects on radicalism and militant action, I think. But apart from that, everything's fine.
No, that's a good kind of breakdown there, Matt. And before I don't want to
massive
dive.
Tangent, Nathan, I'm sorry.
I don't want to dive too much on some of the aspects about kind of like the union itself, because I know we're going to kind of come to talk about it, but I'd agree that, you know, that's the unions nowadays, certainly with probably some of our bigger ones like GMB, Unite, and a couple others, we've regressed into this kind of insurance model where that's kind of like the basis of trade unionism in this country. Now it's how members see it, because when the power and independence isn't given to branches, then, you know, things aren't actually happening there. It's just that assign a couple reps, give them a full-time organiser. If they have any issues, speak to them rather than, you know, trying to give them the tools to develop their own branches, going, this is what you can do, make the most of your branch. There's so many of the kind of like big trade unions we've got in Britain now who, you know, there's no set kind of like guidance for secretaries. It's very much one of these kind of booked positions and everything. And like you say, when it comes to the actions at Rolls-Royce against Pinochet and the fighter jets, then, you know, let's draw reference now to the genocide happening in Gaza. You're not going to get the full-time officials supporting probably even the wishes of a branch, whether it be at BA Systems, Thales, Leonardo, and going, I don't think this is quite right. And the fact that there's union members within these workplaces that don't speak to their union about these kind of issues, these political issues, questions they've got, it's already shown that the fact that the union is not a safe place to talk about it, because they know ultimately their branch is not going to get anywhere with it, will be shot down straight away for a higher up level.
Nathan, I think that's absolutely true, and this is where we draw into this, where we are now. I think that you're absolutely hit the nail on the head there. Because of that move to that insurance model, that was really more of a 90s thing, and it's unfortunately kind of the legacy is very much with us still. We've moved away from what unions are actually about. Right? Obviously, unions, you know, first and foremost, are there to defend members of the workplace, and I suppose that's basic. But actually, they're far more than just that. They're democratic institutions. If you want to live in a society where, as a working class person, you have any sort of an influence or any sort of agency over your life, whether it's your 9 to 5, whether it's to, you know, how much time you've got with your family, whether, you know, you get the money to live, you know, to enjoy a holiday maybe now and again, or eat decent food or whatever. All of that flows back to what's the money in your pocket, what's the level, and that itself obviously flows back to what's the level of influence you have over the world. Now, unfortunately, we've reverted to this idea that increasing the level of influence you have over the world somehow relies on the idea of putting an X in a ballot paper maybe every 5 years or every couple of years, as now with the Scottish Parliament now, or of course we've had ideas for a directly elected mayor now as well. So there's that as well. I mean, I think that's all bollocks. I've got to be quite honest. And I say this as somebody who's an elected member. I have no problem with. Well, I do have a problem with directly elected mayors, but anyway, but I have no problem with Scottish Parliament, no problem with the council's existence or government's existence and people electing them. I don't have a problem with these things. But I think the idea that is democracy, that a vote is democracy. No, a vote is a vote, right? It's not that is not democracy. Democracy is a far broader and more complex and more important thing, actually. Where do people spend most of their days if they're lucky enough to have a job? You spend it at work if you're not asleep, right? And maybe I'd like to get to a world where that is not the case, where far shorter working weeks and working days. But that will only happen with a strong trade union. That won't happen with a cross in a ballot box necessarily, right? If we want the people we elect to do those things, that happens through a strong trade union movement, a democratic trade union, a trade union movement that actually takes political views and doesn't just lurch from crisis to crisis, reacting to one threat of job loss or whatever, this, that, and the other, or offering people their life insurance. It's far more important than that. And actually having, being able to express your views directly in a trade union branch, in some ways is far more important, because in the process of doing that, that engagement and that discussion with your comrades, other people who are living exactly in very similar circumstances to yourself, that strengthens your confidence, that strengthens their confidence, even when you disagree, and you come to resolutions. But the process itself strengthens working class confidence, and that's what they fear. You see, you know, the minute we become confident, we start taking views, like they did in Rolls Royce all those years ago. That's, things change. And that did make Pinochet's life very difficult for a very long time. Just the actions of a handful of guys in East Kilbride, right? It shows you what working people can do. You know, nothing's impossible when we put our minds to it. And that's why so much effort's been done to break that. See, trade unions are political. They're not... There's been all this drift away from politics, all this drift towards the kind of, let's say, the kind of insurance model and things like that. It's about taking politics out of it. Politics is life, right? Politics is having your opinion. Politics is having that debate with your comrades and having the debate with your managers or whatever as well. But the process of having those debates builds your confidence, builds your willingness to actually take a stand on anything, whether it be in the workplace or whether it be in your community. And that's why so much effort over the years has been done to undermine that. That's far more effective and has won far more for working people than a cross in a ballot paper has ever done.
No.
Rant over.
No, a good rant. And I guess I kind of coming back on to talking about the branches
the subject.
How the branch has been kind of like abandoned in some workplaces. It's the kind of damning fucking image now that's kind of scarred into my mind, the state of some of the big unions in Britain was the response to the steelworks and the fact it took Nigel Farage to turn up and stand with shop stewards who, because they've been so neglected by the top of their unions, where they felt like, you know, we're just being left here to wait and see what happens, that Farage has taken this opportunity to come down and, you know, sing the usual kind of populist phrases and everything. And it's this kind of arrogance for some of the top of the unions who believe that, you know, they're a union member, so therefore they're not going to, you know, look to these guys for help outside, you know, our political diaspora or whatever. And it's so out of touch with what actually happens.
My expectation from union leaderships, well, even that phrase is problematic, because I do genuinely think, you know, that ultimately as a union member you're a leader, you know, you and you should act that way. Do you know what I mean? You should try and act that way in your workplace and encourage your companies to do the same, right? But there is a sort of defeatism that's sort of endemic in the movement now. It's like, so you know, there's going to be job losses, so let's negotiate how many job losses there's going to be. There's going to be job losses, so let's negotiate them and make sure they're voluntary rather than compulsory. And I understand why a negotiator has found themselves in that position, finds themselves having to try and get the best deal they can for them. I get that. I understand that. Right? I'm not so naive on that score. But there is something, a wider cultural thing there about we're not really standing up enough and just saying, no. No, that's not happening. Okay. So you can shut this factory down, or if you want, you and the management and the owners, you can all fuck off. But it's ours now. If you walk away, we're running it. You know what I mean? I think we need a bit more of that attitude. Because the idea is, to use the steel example, the idea isn't a market for steel is ludicrous. Right? I mean, the underlying issue is energy, but that's another issue, of course, altogether. We can have a whole different podcast on that one. But really, what people should be encouraging workers to believe is you guys know how to run the plant. The guys that own it don't know how to run the bloody plant. You know how to run the plant. You run it every day. The managers don't even know how to run the plant. Right? That's the truth. You run the plant. If people want to buy the steel, make the steel, sell it. Right? I mean, this is... all of this comes... all of these sorts of debates come from the point of view that the worker is just flotsam and jetsam in this ocean of capitalism, you know, that we can't do anything for us. Well, actually, we can fight back. And the fight back always begins in the work... always has, always will, begins in the workplace. Whether it's the steelworks, whether it's the sorting office, whether it's the distillery, whether it's, whether it's the bottling... whatever, right, you know, that... It doesn't mean to say you're running a revolution from every plant in the world, right? But what I'm saying, not yet, but what I'm saying is you have to at least put up a fight, and the unions nationally need to be seen to be backing people. See, if a branch says we're not having it, we're not having this works close, the union nationally should instinctively say we are with you, and we will put the full might of our union. And we'll draw as best we can the rest of the trade union movement in behind you as well. We will back you every step of the way. And we will talk to our comrades in other workplaces to see how they can support you. That's what has to happen, rather than just a negotiation about, oh, well, you know, it might shut in 6 months rather than three. I mean, that's not good enough. And when those sorts of fights are not taken up, they are taken up by the populist far right. And that's what we saw in Scunthorpe. I mean, it ended up getting nationalised basically because the Labour government got embarrassed into it. I mean, that is just, that's not good enough. The union should have been calling for nationalisation day one.
Bang on. Realm,
which is quite damning, I think.
Aye. No, I mean, this whole topic and what we're talking about and the bringing it back to the workplaces, it's something, you know, like, McGahey always kept with him, even through his progression through the union's own bodies as well. Obviously, still being active and drawing everything back to the branches, to the workplaces, every single step of the way, whether it was his involvement in the Scottish Executive and the NUM in 1958 or whatever it was, but mm-hmm. even to when he was elected president of the Scottish area as well in like 67. Yeah. So, it was always bringing that back compared to what we've got now, and we just kind of, you know, leave workplaces till they're in such dire straits that, again, like you said, that leadership of the union has to kind of come in and basically just conduct damage limitation and just be like, all right, we'll take these folk, blah, 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 and basically just beg on its knees for like a best deal possible.
Oh, absolutely. And there is another phenomenon which runs alongside this as well, is this, I'm not saying it's necessarily new, but it seems to be a greater issue than it was maybe in the past, is that you have full-time officers. I mean people who are full-time paid union officials here rather than people who've been elected to positions necessarily, who sometimes forget that they are employees of the members, right? They think they are leading the members. Now, their job, just as another tangent, advice I always give to anybody who attains elected office is never ask an officer of the council or parliament or whatever, never ask if you can do something, ask how. That's a really important distinction. Too many people ask if, and they go, oh, no, that sounds, because everybody in these institutions is risk averse, right? So if you ask them how you do something like that, you get a very different answer. You go away and have a think and go, all right, okay, they might be able to get around it this way or whatever the issue might be. There's a similar sort of managerialism has crept into bits of the trade union movement. I think we need to level ourselves about that. Where there do seem to be officers who hold certain positions who generally take the views that their function is to keep the show on the road, and the show on the road, keeping the show on the road means keeping things as they are, supporting the continuing existence of the union, doing the XYZ. I mean, I'm not saying the union should be allowed to collapse or anything like that, but that becomes the priority, right? Just because for cultural reasons, not because any of these people are necessarily evil, but because for cultural reasons, they end up that becomes the life, that becomes the purpose. But they also feel empowered. No doubt, I think, sadly, in certain cases, because of the sort of wage brackets they're on, if I'm honest as well, is they sort of forget that they think they are the boss. I hate the phrase when people talk about union barons and union bosses, because they shouldn't be either of those things, right? I can just about live with the idea of leaders. But bosses and barons, no, that's not what we're for, right? We're supposed to be about the opposite. And I think that... There is a sort of a problem there, a managerialism that's crept in where people forget that they work for the workers. They work to support the actions of the branches. They work to support the needs and wants and aspirations of their members, rather than to glorify or to establish their institution, right? Or even worse, I think there's bound to be a couple of occasions where it's basically just seen purely as from a job point of view, and off they'll go to another one in a few years' time somewhere else in the private sector. Right? It does happen, unfortunately. I don't think there's any substitute for people that have come through the ranks and actually faced an angry gaffer, to be perfectly honest with you. I think I'm not going to write off everybody who's maybe just gone straight for uni and gone into a research job in a union, because I think there's a need for, there's a place for that, right? But I think if you... I think the balance is a bit out of kilter just at the moment in bits of the trade union movement. I think we need to sort ourselves out. We need to make sure we're bringing actively supporting and encouraging education of people that are interested in the workplace, bringing them on, supporting them through the movement as potential leaders of a class in the future. But making sure they don't lose their way. Making sure they remember why they got involved in it, and making sure that they don't forget and they don't start thinking about their own career rather than thinking about the careers and livelihoods of the people that they're supposed to be there to represent. I think sometimes there's a disconnect occurs.
Yeah. Sounds like we need more Mick McGahies and less Joe Gromleys, as I'll come on to talk about just now.
And that was a great segue there, Nathan.
So I've led myself onto that. We talk about these folk in the unions and all that, and the role they play in kind of de-radicalising the movement and the structures of the union themselves. And that's certainly no new thing, collaboration with the state in terms of de-radicalising people when trying to hamper militancy in the branches as well. Looking at Mick McGahey's life during his runs for reaching higher positions within the NUM, it was usually didn't quite make it to present, but obviously done it at Scottish present level. But he was beat out of the presidency by Joseph Gromley, now remembered as Baron Gromley, one of these careerists, like you said, is looked forward rather than looking around him to the the men who put him in the position that he was in at the NUM for a present. But in Gromley's case, it was stated that he'd been passing on information to Special Branch about extremism within the union, i.e., ratting out any stalwarty communists and socialists and just in general militant trade unionists as well. And there was Special Branch a Special Branch officer had stated that this allegation said against Cromley was that he loved his country, he was a patriot, he was very worried and worried about militancy within his own union. And judging by how Gromley's life would play out, would be that he'd abandon his own workers, accept becoming a Labour peer and be appointed an OBE in the 1970s, New Year's Honour. And very recently, it's been written about other three union leaders, probably barons in the near future, who've
I do
accepted
hope not,
already.
but anyway, yeah.
They've already accepted, wishes from the King Orders, OBEs and CBEs. But I guess back to the kind of broader aspect of MI5 and state involvement in the unions, it's always been a case of the British state working to kind of infiltrate the unions to stop, like what we've been talking about, the branches being the arrowhead for action in any dispute, not waiting on national guidance or approval before conducting anything. And next time we can see with that accusation against Gromley informing to Special Branch. McGaughey often had his phone tapped as well by MI5 trying to listen in to any and all conversations. But it's clearly
There
something
was a
that.
funny story I heard once about that. I don't know if it's true, but there was a story that an MI5 had been operative had been carrying out a wiretap and couldn't make out what he was saying, and they couldn't figure out whether it was because he'd been at the pub or whether it had been or whether it was his accent. Well, more so in those days, the MI5 types were very much the Oxbridge types. They probably had no clue. Could he make their way through the Lanarkshire accent? I love the thought of that somebody's sitting on the other end of the line has no scooby. What's going on? Maybe that was all part of an elaborate plan on Mick's behalf. I don't know.
I think that's justified. I think it says in his Wikipedia page that his distinct gravelly voice. I think
Yes,
Scotland
yes.
Yard might have been too used to hear it. But I mean, obviously we had that in Mick's time and certainly against him. And let's face it, in today's movement, we've still got the same. It's just in a different level with new technology, and it's still the same fight, however, against militant members in the union and trying to silence them through all different means. I don't know if I want to perjure myself this early in my investigation, but I'll leave that gossip
I
to
don't
those
want to
who
get you any
know.
bother here.
But
Well, I think to some extent, like if you think about it, right? If you're the establishment, but this goes back, you go back a century on this more, and you're the establishment in Britain, and you're running a domestic intelligence agency. Back in, say, in the 20s, there's just been a revolution in Russia. What are you going to do? Right, it's obvious what you're going to do, right? I mean, there's a sense where I'd be more surprised if the intelligence services weren't tapping people's phones, or infiltrating, trying to infiltrate memberships and all the rest of it, and agitating their own ways in branches. I'd be more surprised if they hadn't done that than I have. And I was sort of brought up with, again, I was my father drummed this into me very, very early. Because I'm pretty sure back in the 80s, my dad worked in telecoms, of course, which is an interesting thing on this score. But he was convinced his phone had been tapped at one point during the 86 strike in British Telecom, because he was up to some nonsense. I'm not going to lie, you know. I mean, I can say this now, he's passed away. He would make occasional trips of an evening to telephone exchanges with a hammer. Anyway, we'll leave it at that. I guess beyond the statute of limitations. But he was, you know, there was stuff going on. And but there would have been hundreds and hundreds just like him, and no doubt people who held far more pivotal roles than he did at that time as well, and I'm sure were being monitored far more closely. It's actually just something that if you're going to be active in the trade union movement, and if you're going to be militant in the trade union movement, frankly, you have to live with that reality. See, that was drummed into me when I was young. I remember going on a march with my dad. I must have been about 10 year old or something like that, through the city centre in Glasgow. In my naivety, I seen people hanging, they were kind of hanging for the posts like this, taking their pictures, and I thought, "Oh, that's the press. Are we going to be in the?" I said to him, "Are we going to be in the paper tomorrow?" He said, "No, I know him." I mean, what do you mean? The guy was we lived in Silcotes at the time. The guy was it was a police officer in Silcotes, earning a bit of overtime in plain clothes, taking pictures. So my dad waved at him just to wind him up. I mean, this sort of stuff's just it's just there, right? And it is an extent where we have to just sort of live with it, right? And you have to, I'm not saying it's right, but it's there. It's not going to go away anytime soon. I'll tell you something though. Back to if we can jump back to this kind of, if you like, local action versus central action point. This is crucial to this, you know. You think about it. If you are the establishment and you want to hobble the political power of a trade union, and you want to hobble radicalism in a trade union, what, and you want to influence the direction of a trade union or the wider movement, what is easier to influence, one, a heavily centralized one, or one that's decentralized? I know what's easier, right? So a decentralized one with active members scattered all over the country and in active militant members in branches, the length and breadth of the country, is far, far more of a challenge to the establishment than even a radically led centralized one, right? Because you have those, how do they keep ta you know, even in this day and age, that's a far harder thing to manage. And that's again why it suits the states, it's the establishment to have these things centralized. And that's exactly why we should be moving in the opposite direction.
Yeah. No,
There you
bang
go.
on.
Sorry, that was another tangent for you.
No, I think that was quite good. I mean, talking even just on that kind of point there would be looking at workplaces where kind of action would be most effective or certainly hamper and cause difficulty to the state and the establishment would be like we've already talked about with the defence sector, as it's often characterized as BAE Systems, Thales, Leonardo, all these places. And again, if we're looking at the relationship that some in the trade union have towards this, it's continuously protecting it and making sure that it's only about improving just pay and just this. Meanwhile, they're coerced away, from standing with anti-war protesters, Palestinian solidarity activists, and everyone else in between. And when, I guess, from personal experience, when you criticize that line, when you emphasize the point that, I'm constantly piling all this money into weapons warfare and then shipping it off to be used in ongoing conflicts that are escalating and escalating to the point now where we're very closely looking at an outbreak of a third world war, either originating in the Middle East or Eastern Europe, then how can use a union leader, these union barons, justify the excuse of saying, it's jobs, it's opportunities, it's a future. But the reality is it's not going to be a future for young members like myself who, if I'm a young person joining the union, getting a job there, then it's going to be me and folks similar to my age who are the first ones shipped out in
Absolutely.
conscription to fight as well. And when there's so much protection around one very specific line that you can't criticize, then it's clear to see where that state influences in regards to protecting so-called industries and opportunities, and who yeah. comes to speak at events and who doesn't, who's given table number one, and we'll put the anti-war ones right at the back of the hall, just out of sight and out of mind, you know what I mean? So it's all these patterns.
There's a thing that you again, you know, better coming from your mouth than mine, you know, as an old man. But you know, at the end of the day, you'd be, as you say, you're in the age group, you would get conscripted. I'm probably just a scope there. But the idea that war is a future, or a war economy is the future, is just, it is such a mind-blowing thing to hear. I mean, I went to the Scottish Labour Party conference for my sins last year, and I heard Keir Starmer's speech. And I mean, he's not exactly an inspirational speaker. Sometimes you can get people who are quite, you know, quite good communicators, but what they're communicating is a load of nonsense. No, he's not even a good communicator. But what he was communicating, I'll tell you, wasn't nonsense. It was bloody dangerous. I mean, he actually used phrases like war economy and putting Britain on a war footing. I mean, that is, to hear that from, I mean, we can argue that maybe previous prime ministers of, you know, post-war have had those thoughts and maybe made those sorts of actions. But to say it like that, so explicitly, and expect to be cheered to the rafters, which presumably he did, was quite something. I was really quite shocked. There was a time when that would have been even shocking for a Tory prime minister to have come out and said so explicitly like that. They're not normally as daft as to say it quite as openly. And I think it is. Do you know something? It shows an absolute lack of imagination. There's actually an old phrase, a criticism Michael Foote once made of Maggie Thatcher. And I might get the phrase slightly out a wee bit. So I'm sure if anybody wants to correct me, feel free. But he basically said she has no imagination, and because she has no imagination, she has no sympathy. Because if you can't begin to imagine, yeah, I have no decent imagination. You can't possibly imagine what it's like to be in the receiving end of one of those bombs. You can't possibly imagine what it's like to live in grinding poverty. You can't possibly imagine what it's like to have to board one of those dinghies to cross the channel in the hope of a better life. You can't possibly even begin to imagine these things. And so if you can't begin to imagine these things, you can't have sympathy with them. You need imagination. You need imagination to be a socialist, actually. Because you need imagination to be an optimist at times as well, right? And these things all go hand in hand. It's not about being naive. It's not about being daft. You need to imagine something better and imagine the struggles that other people are facing in order to try and do something about that, right? And I think we are suffering in our political classes right now an absolute dearth of imagination, to the point where we have a prime minister coming in. He wants to, apparently, you know, spend some money getting the economy back on its feet. So what does he think of? Well, we're going to make bombs and sell bombs because Britain has historically exported a lot of bombs. And sometimes on our own jets, sometimes on ours. You know, that's it. That's the extent of our ambitions, is it really? I mean, that is pathetic. You think, you know, I've stood out, you know, reporting from Star, I've stood outside protests at Leonardo's over in Edinburgh, and obviously at BAE and Talis. These are full of extraordinarily highly skilled workers. Extraordinarily highly skilled workers, really, really highly trained workers. And you're not going to tell me every one of them is happy with how their day's work ends up. I don't believe that. One of the reasons I don't believe that is because I've spoken to a number of them, right? Maybe you won't go on record. And like, of course, they're human beings, right? They don't like the idea of going to work. They're making some component that they focus on and do a great job of making. But they don't like the idea of comprehending that might be gone off and being used to kill a kid somewhere. Of course they don't. These are not terrible people. Just as the people who for years, you know, made those engines and all the rest over in Rolls Royce are not terrible people. what changed it over at Rolls Royce? I know I'm jumping back to that one again. Was that they take a political line, and again back to that localist argument, those branches are not having these discussions. So if they're not having these discussions, those workers don't know what's possible. They can't look beyond this product that they're making and think, actually, this is the wider impact of this product they're making. And actually, there's also a wider impact to me choosing not to make this product or not to allow that to be sent off to this. And you know, we talk about a just transition for oil and gas workers. We should be building exactly the same. It's exactly the same challenge. Highly skilled workers that we should be backing. We back the workers. We back them to build an alternative, a proper plan for an alternative. Let's put our imagination to work doing this. You think all these researchers and everything that work for all these trade unions and political parties, for that matter, apparently these are all highly intelligent, gifted people, apparently, and they can't come up with a plan to put those talents to work to give people better lives rather than killing them. I don't believe that. What's missing is political will and imagination, which I think which, talking of lack of political will and imagination, I think takes us neatly to the Scottish Parliament, if you don't mind me saying so.
No, that's good. I mean, you're reminding me of talking to Starmer. It's all the videos you see of him, you know, the G7 summit, walking about, doing all these promos. And I think it was somebody on Twitter who put all this effort to cultivate a cult of personality for somebody with no personality. But that's the line he's taken is just the same old pattern, representing just so boringly and vaguely as well. You know, the wishes of, you know, the ruling class. And, you know, you're touching on the war economy and the new red austerity that we've now got under the Labour government, is instead of getting people back up on their feet with a actual funded welfare programme and, you know, actual job opportunities, the war economy gets them back up on their feet by attaching a modern warfare exoskeleton onto them and sending them out. Yeah. That's the reality of getting them up on their feet under a war economy.
There's a really important sort of boring economic point on this one as well. I hope I get these stats right, but if they're not perfect, I won't be far off, I promise you. When the state spends money in the economy, there's a multiplier effect, as we, you know, in terms of how it ripples out. The multiplier effect, I mean, in terms of all the different types of state spending that could go on, the multiplier effect is lower in defence spending than it is in just about anything else. So if you spend money on health, you get a multiplier effect because you're paying people wages, you know, paying the doctors and nurses and assistants and everybody, you're paying people wages, you're building hospitals, it has that ripple out into the economy. And as well as making people healthier, crazy thought, all these things have a positive effect on the economy. If you're spending money on social care, it has a positive effect on the economy. People can get back on their feet again, people can be supported to have decent lives and all the rest of that. And again, wages is obviously the obvious way of getting the money out. Defence, it's not the case at all. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you actually don't employ that many people per pound of spend, really, right? Not that I'm saying they should all be chucked the dole, but you don't employ, it doesn't actually generate as many jobs, firstly. Secondly, the actual value added, if you like, doesn't stay here. It disappears off to some far off land, you know, that has, you know, some tax haven somewhere, right? Well, by and large, right? Whereas if you're spending money on social care, pretty much, well, unless you're spending some of the kind of, you know, kind of, there are some, in fairness, it's maybe not the best example, because there are some care homes, unfortunately, still owned by huge foreign capital investment arms. But if we avoid that, then you're actually keeping the money circulating in the public, in the realm, and you're actually making people better as you did. Instead, they seem to prioritise making enormous profits for people who never put the money back into the economy. You see, this is, again, a lack of imagination, because their idea, their measure of a functioning economy is this is a GDP predicated on profit, are measurements that don't mean anything maybe to you and I, and don't mean anything in terms of getting our public services or giving people a decent life. These things are not measured properly. So they can't think beyond these things, so they just don't try. You know, if we spent a fraction of that money a fraction of that money getting our public services back on our feet, our economy would go through the roof. I mean, if you really want, there is like an old thing. See, if you really wanted to immediately see an uptick in growth, just double unemployment benefit or double universal credit. You would immediately, because these people aren't squirrely, you know, anybody who's claiming that, right? They're only taking that money off to the Swiss bank account. They're spending it. They'll spend it in a local shop so they can eat properly rather than go to your food bank, right? They're spending it. They're paying their bills and all that. The economy grows, right? It doesn't grow when you give it to somebody to go and squirrel it away in the Bahamas, right? It's nonsense. So it's this utter lack of imagination that it's somehow possible to spend on the public good and also to come up with economic growth. The leadership of the political leadership of our country seems to think that good public spending equals big profits and rocketing FTSE. It doesn't mean social care spend. In fact, they positively see being tough on social things like social care and benefits and all the rest of it, and welfare spending, as being tough on that as a sort of badge of honour, as a way of like galvanising the market to rally behind them and lend them money. It's bollocks, because even the market laughs at that. The market doesn't even believe it, right? So even if you're playing that capitalist game, they don't even believe that. It's just this weird sort of political doom loop that they've gotten themselves into. And they need to start raising their heads and actually look around them, because our cities and towns are crumbling around us. People are struggling. They can't fucking feed their families. You know, where, I mean, 15 years ago, there was barely any food banks in this country. Now they're absolutely endemic. They're in every bloody community, and there's queues at them. And they're going to get worse.
Yeah.
And they're not going to get better by sending bombs abroad. You know? This doesn't work.
Yeah.
Not one person will be taken out of a food bank queue because of that. Bollocks, I'm afraid. Sorry, I'm getting annoyed now. it's not even a capitalist economist doesn't look at this and think this works. It doesn't. It's quite obviously doesn't work, right?
Spot on. It kind of brings us in the most
pragmatic way.
It brings us kind of onto the next point there as well. You know, it comes back to McGahey's kind of quote on, you know, we're a movement, not a monument. How we kind of take that slogan and, you know, the task before us today. I like to say it's a fucking easy answer in terms of, you know, what to do, but certainly no. You know, we've already talked about kind of union democracy and the structures themselves hampering us. We're already talking about, you know, the state and the war economy. So it's like being bludgeoned for, you know, both sides of the skull, and, you know, how we actually do it. And to me, it certainly seems that the way forward for it is first and foremost bringing that democracy back into the unions, getting more young people especially, because let's face it, union membership has continued to decline. It's no really went up by that much. It's in real terms declining across every single union.
It's pretty much retreated to the public sector as well.
Yeah,
you know, union penetration in the private sector is nothing like what it was two or three decades ago even. And that's a major issue, you know, because it's. I'm not saying it's not without its challenges, but it's easier to organise in the public sector, much easier to organise in the public sector than it is in the private sector, right? And when sectors where you've seen a big growth over, you know, like the service sectors over the last, you know, 4 decades, as manufacturing's declined, service sector's grown. It's actually, it's very, I mean, I'm sure I don't need to tell anybody listening to this, but it's very difficult to organise in the service sector. You know, our comrades in United Hospitality will tell you that. It's not easy. But it needs to happen. It needs to happen. And, I mean, this is another problem where it's back to that kind of model that trade unionism in Britain has kind of slipped into, is that it's a defensive model where they've just tried to hang on to what they've got, largely in the public sector and the very big employers. And actually, what's been allowed to sort of slide is the other stuff where actually the economy's, you know, where the relative size of the economy's growing. So hospitality is a perfect example of that. There's never been particularly great union membership in that. But the bloody well should be. It's a massive chunk of the economy. Rightly or wrongly, it is. And where the workers are, that's where unions should be. That's the bottom line, right? So, and it's incredibly hard to organise in those communities. So guess what? See all those well-paid organisers and everything we have, and researchers and all the people that trade, all that brain power we've got in the trade union, they should be supporting those workers on the ground. I know they are, it's certainly, I know there's examples that in Glasgow, I've seen it. But we need far, far more of that. You don't actually win by going for the easy stuff. It's like in a debate, you never attack people in a debate on their weakest point. You attack them on what they think is where they think they're strongest. Where they think they're strongest is these deregulated sectors. If we can make an impact as trade unionists in those deregulated sectors, then everything falls. The whole pack of cards can fall, right? Yeah. You don't go for the easy stuff.
Nah, I think even the new, like the way the deck is kind of like stacked in terms of, maybe I want to use the word repression. I think it is probably the most fitting word, but the repression that we see for militant folk within the unions, I think the best place for them, well, not the best place, but another place to organise in is the trades councils as well, specifically, because absolutely. let's look at the STUC as an example for that. It's these trades councils, a collective body, union members, reps, etc., from all these different workplaces across a local authority or wherever, and they're the ones putting in some of the most progressive motions at STUC that go against the line of the establishment, which is that, promoting a war economy and, not prioritising welfare. We're setting aside the interests of those in terms of like social production for imperialist production. Look at the struggle we've already got with the ferries and everything. RMT is certainly on their own with that because, and kind of referencing back to RMT, it was great to hear Eddie both at the STUC talking about, solidarity striking as well and, the fight for that. You already touched on, we've got some of the most draconian trade union laws imaginable. And for those who don't know, well, I don't think most people know about, union legislation and the laws and everything and what it entails whenever there's
a lot of it.
Yeah, whenever there's a strike by RMT, ASLEV, they're always like, oh, why can't they just do what Japan does? I'm like, because legally in Japan they can. They'd arrest reps, members and everything for carrying out the same work. And, I think for the TUCs playing that part of being this collective body, the workers in the union that are progressive, that are militant, that's certainly an avenue for them to go down. Because if, you're pushing this stuff at an STC level, gives you your members and your branch an even stronger mandate to work on and, bringing kind of democracy closer when the union's already taken it to an office somewhere down in London. It's bringing it all back to as local as you can go.
I think that's a really good point. Trades councils have become, they always were this, but also branches at one time were as well. That's increasingly not the case, sadly. But they are now that political space where trade unions can have an actual political discussion on the wider issues and also can find common cause with each other. It's a space where you can talk to folk from other trade unions that are like-minded or maybe not like-minded. You can have the debate or whatever. But the point is you've got the space to do it. Whereas quite often you can end up in your workplace and you can't, it's just this thing about imagination again. Sometimes it's hard to say, well, what are they up to down the road? What are they out for? What's going on? And if you have an understanding in your town or in your city, what the various struggles that are going on, rather than sitting in all these silos, then that's an amazing strength, isn't it? I mean, there's a reason why, going away back, that actually it was the trades councils were played a massive role in building in some of the great radical actions, certainly in Scotland and certainly in Glasgow. It's amazing, amazing history there, but obviously Clydebank as well. I mean, you can point to all over the place. That's also the reason, dare I say it, why trades councils don't have a seat at the TUC Congress. if I was a cynical man. Right. And I do think that, you know, what conscious of, you know, I'm not a big fan of going, isn't life wonderful in Scotland and aren't we special? But one thing I will say for the SDUC, and one thing I think which has kept the SDUC reasonably honest, even in moments where it's been adrift a little bit, you know, historically, is the trades the role of the trades councils at Congress. As you say, they have brought an edge to it, which has meant that if you look over the decades, the SDUC has taken some pretty good lines on things, actually, that maybe wouldn't have got through other, in fact, definitely wouldn't have got through otherwise if it'd just been left to the delegates, you know, like the delegates from the delegations from various unions themselves, because there's more opportunity for kind of free and open discussion of them, you know. Sad that it is that way, but that's how it is. So yeah, trades council are absolutely vital, and they're more vital now than ever, because it's really, really important, particularly this argument about defence, is that it's not about demonising defence workers. I think it's really important that we don't do that. But it is important that they're in the room and having these discussions. You know, like, you know where you are, there'll be defence workers, I'm sure, in your trades council. So, you know, they should be in the room when you're having these sorts of discussions about the world situation. You know, and they'll have concerns. They'll have worries about, well, does that mean I lose my job? Well, it's important we hear that. It's important we work with them to try and find a future that is beyond this war economy. You know, there's no other place we can have that discussion. So the trades councils are absolutely vital. And, you know, because I think the Scottish, you know, Westminster's is a hell of a pickle, and that's for sure. But I mean, I think the Scottish Parliament has become massively depoliticised, if it was ever politicised in the first place. Councils have been hauled out. I've seen that firsthand. So where is the politics happening? Where is the interest in some of that? As ever, if we're honest, back to what I said at the beginning, workplaces. And the key thing to build working class confidence, and working class confidence is what will change the world and what has always changed the world for us, is allowing people to talk to other people in similar struggle. And building that understanding that the guy down the road, working in Faz Lane is not necessarily evil, but he's got his own problems as well, just as you have. And how do we work together here to get a better world out of this? And that's just the same as the person who's struggling away in France or in Germany or whatever we want to be, the person in Gaza in the dust, right? These are the same struggles. These are the same struggles.
Yeah.
And we can all affect each other's struggles. I understand, because you're told every day as a working class person that you can't have influence. It's just the way the world is. You know, you're just one person. You know? But you're not just one person when you're in a union. You're not just one person when you're in a trades council. You can do something. You know, and that's the bit everybody's frightened of. You know. You know, that's how we frighten them.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, Matt. You can allude on to the kind of end bit we're talking about, the unveiling of Mick McGahey's bust, yes, within Scottish Parliament, and yeah, kind of how Holyrood stands in this contrast to his vision of a workers' parliament. I think it stands in contrast to all our visions of any form of workers' democracy. So it's just to see if you can give us both. I'll split this into, I guess, a kind of breakdown into, you know, how Mick saw a Scottish Parliament, a workers' parliament, and how it would act. And then, I guess, the second part, just obviously your reflection on being there for the unveiling of his bust and the kind of, torture that his spirit has to endure, and looking over the floor of Holyrood and you know, seeing the circus, mm-hmm, that's, you know, unfolding before him.
Well, I'll just do a wee plug for my piece. I did write a wee piece in the Morning Star about it, if anybody wants to look it up. Because I was quite moved by it in one way, you know. I went along, and it was organised by Richard Leonard, who's not only a good socialist, but a good historian as well. You know, he's You know, he's probably forgotten more about Mick McGaughey than I'll ever know, you know. And he'd made it a sort of a personal mission, I think, to get something in Parliament to actually acknowledge his role in getting the thing, to acknowledge Mick McGaughey's role in the Parliament occurring in the first place. And it was a key role. So back in 68, newly elected president of the NUM in Scotland, and he stood up at the SDUC and he moved a motion asking it to back home rule, back a Scottish Assembly, as they would have called it back. And the motion, interestingly, was defeated. So it's an important point to make, right? It was not a given that this was going to pass at all, and that's why it didn't. But the point was, he planted a seed. And I think there's an important lesson in that as well for us all, is that you don't win every battle, you know? Is that sometimes when you're engaging in a skirmish or whatever, you're just planting a seed. You're putting a wee flag in the ground saying, this is where we are. Now, let's talk about it. And he did that. And you know, he got the Scottish trade union movement talking about that issue again. Because it had been an issue way back, and it's sort of been forgotten with everything else, because there's always 101 other things to get on with, isn't it? And so he put it back on the agenda. And you think about it, 10 years or 11 years later, 79, I think it was, there was a referendum on a Scottish Parliament. Now, because there was a two-thirds rule, or there was a rule that you had to be at least a third of the possible electorate voted for it, or something like that. I can't remember exactly. The Cunningham Amendment, they called it, in order for it to pass. So although the majority of those who voted in it voted for a Scottish Parliament, it fell just short of the line required. So you can imagine the anger on the back of that, right? But think about that, though. That's something that hadn't really been on the agenda of the Scottish Labour and Trade Union movement for a long, long time. It was by the way, it's by no means universally supported in the Labour Party, even in 79, or even 10 years beyond. And it was by no means universally supported in the trade union movement. But in the space of 10 or 11 years, you've got that onto the political agenda to such an extent that a government that is struggling in a minority situation manages to get that to at least put to the people in a referendum, right? Now, that is a remarkable thing. And why did that happen? Well, it didn't happen because Jim Callaghan just had this great vision of a Scottish Parliament. It happened because the Scottish Labour and Trade Union movement decided that this was a priority, that this was an important part of a democratisation of society. That's why it happened. The government was made to do it. And again, and that's another lesson, I think. You know, it was a reasonably left government at that time compared to many others, I guess. But ultimately, it reacted to pressure from the trade union movement, right? Because it had to listen, right? You know, even Thatcher, again, forgotten about, Thatcher was elected in 79. She was elected promising a Scottish Parliament or a Scottish Assembly, right? A promise she forgot, but I mean, she was obviously at it. But the point is, she felt she needed to say it, right, at that time. By the time you get to 83, you know, she doesn't feel the need to say it anymore, right? But she had felt the need to say it then. Now, why was that? Well, it's because there was at least some general understanding across Scotland that there was a need for something to occur. And that didn't just fall from the sky. And you know, the role of the trade union movement in getting that to that point is absolutely crucial. So then through the 80s, we get the whole movement broadens again. But all of that building, if you like, that was a turning point in 68. And I'm one of these, just like I'm wary of great mind theories, I'm also wary of just a single turning point thing. But that is an important staging post. That speech, that ask at that SDU Congress was an important stepping stone to what came later. And yeah, it did take a few decades to get there, and he didn't actually see it. And as I said, he died 2 or 3 months before the first Scottish parliamentary election, sadly. So he never got to cast his vote in it. But yeah, so you know, the role he played is definitely is I think is worth definitely worth acknowledging, and is probably far greater than just about any individual, I think. Any other individual. Arguably even more than Donald Dewar, he seems to get a lot of the credit for it. Now, but I remember sitting there, I was listening to the speeches, and Richard gave a very good speech. We had comrades from the NUM also spoke very well. Ros Feuergate spoke very well, and she particularly spoke about how she met him as a young trade unionist, was inspired, and all the rest of that. And that's all very nice. And but I remember just sort of looking over my shoulder at the bust, because the bust is sitting behind, and it was looking out the window where it's sitting. If you ever find yourself in Parliament, and it's looking out the window at the crags, I remember thinking to myself. And it's a very good bust. It's got him down to a team, you know. And he's looking out there, and I'm thinking, yep, I'd be doing the same, mate. Because you're like, there's somebody who put, as part of a movement, that's a really important point to make, put so much effort into getting this thing, this institution he hoped would bring power closer to people. And make people feel more able to interact with power, make power less of another, right? And what have we got? And what have we got? We're 25 years in, and I just see it's a real, you know, porridge managerialism. You know, it's just agonizing at times to watch, where. You know, I mean, the most radical act of it. I mean, I remember seeing Jack McConnell asked when he lost power in 2007. What's the single thing you're most proud of as First Minister? And it was a smoking ban. Right now, fine. I mean, smoking ban arguably is, you know, I'm sure you could argue that it saved a lot of lives and all the rest of that. And it's, you know, okay, fair enough. But really, but that's it. Really, seriously, though? Really? You know, and that was after Ireland had done it, after, you know, happened, I think, over New York it had been done before it got to Scotland and everything. And I thought, okay, that's, you know, from a health point of view, worth doing, maybe. But really, you had that power, and this is what you did with it. I get there are restrictions to parliamentary power and all this, and you know, you take things into Parliament, you get overturned. You know, you're negotiating with colleagues. All right, I know that because I've been there in the council, and you know, I understand how these things go. Right, things get watered down and they get bounced around. I get it. You don't always get your own way, but I thought that was quite telling. All that hope, and you think about it at that time as well. At that time, there was a power to vary income tax by a penny one way or the other, which. Not a great power, in fairness, but it was there. Nobody had used it. And it wasn't used for another decade. And I just think, what are we... Really? Really? Is that the thing you must chuffed at? You know, I just think, if you get yourself in a position of power, what are you going to do with it, right? And it's not just about, I said there are limitations because you have to negotiate with colleagues. There's huge executive power as well where it goes with these roles. Bloody use them, right? And I don't see it happening. I see everything, even the, I'm sure if you asked any Scottish government ministers right now, like SNP ministers, what are they most proud of? Or they might say something like the child payment. Or maybe the mitigation of the bedroom tax, but they had to mean, or they're talking about mitigating the two child cap. All of those things, very laudable, right? Never going to have me arguing against any of those things. However, I was a parliamentary committee arguing against the bedroom tax 18 months before they decided to mitigate it. People were lining up and telling them how they could do it before it even came in, and they didn't do it. Because they were saying, well, it's not in our powers. We can't do it. And it was back to that thing I said earlier on. They weren't asking the right question. They weren't asking how to do something. They were asking if. And we were all telling them different ways they could work around and do it, right? Now, maybe in an ideal world, they wouldn't have to work around, but that doesn't matter a damn. If you've got the power to do something, you do it, right? You do it. And they could have done something for Lucy, and they had to be actually embarrassed into doing it. I remember thinking, why the fuck would you do that? I remember John Swinney infamously stood up in Parliament when that whole debate was going on for those 18 months while people were running up debt. And he stood up, he actually said this. You can check the records. He said he didn't want to let the government, or the UK government, off the hook. Now think about that. Think about what the implications of that. Think about what mindset takes you to the point where saying that is okay, right? I get there are limitations to the Scottish Parliament, and we can argue about, you know, whether they should be there or whether they should not. But if your attitude in that situation is it's that guy over there, it's his fault, so I'm not doing it, and I don't want to carry the can here. It should be pointing out that's not good enough. You're in a position of leadership. You're in a position where you can do something. You bloody do it. And then, if necessary, you embarrass them, the guys down the road, and say, look, we're fixing this. We're fixing your problem. But say you're fixing it. Don't say we're not fixing it. And that's what they did.
Yeah, I suppose it's one of the kind of bittersweet things where it's like, you know, maybe it's maybe Mickey's lucky that he was born in the period that he was, and maybe not too later to actually see what the Scottish Parliament's become.
I just think he'd been horrified by this stuff, you know. And I don't think any party comes out of this well, by the way. But certainly no party in the Scottish Parliament comes out of this. I mean, the Labour Party is certainly implicated in this thinking or lack of thinking up to our neck. The Liberals were when they were in with the Labour Party. The SNP are definitely in it up to their neck because, frankly, because they've been in so long, apart from anything else, they're about as managerialist an administration as I've ever seen in my life, anywhere in the world. And the Greens were roped into it. You know, they were in it up to their necks. You know, they sold their souls for a ministerial ride. And you just think, where's the radicalism now? Where's the challenge to the status quo? It's not coming from in there. Now, maybe that's a lot to ask of a parliament. Maybe parliaments don't challenge themselves. Maybe we're asking too much. But one thing we can definitely say is it's not a workers' parliament. There is no way in shape or form that is a workers' parliament in there. Everything, every little bit of support for working people that's been dragged out of that parliament has been dragged out of it, kicking and screaming. From ministers who would regard themselves as of the left, because they're frightened. They're frightened of the officer class. There is no political leadership. There is no challenge to the civil service are running the show. And again, not to pick on civil servants, there's a lot of good civil servants in it. But the truth is, you know, civil service has a culture. It has, and its culture is to manage the status quo as it is. For the civil service to work at its capacity, to work at what it's capable of, because there's lots of very able people in there, then it needs political leadership. And if ministers are not going into those meetings with senior civil servants and saying, this is my political agenda, here's the, you go away and find me ways to make this happen by the end of the week, off you go, right? Because that's their job. Rather than going in and going, do you think we can do this? Right? Or even worse, just not doing that at all, right? Now, reality is what's happening is those latter two options rather than the first. So I don't blame the civil servants for this. They're just doing their jobs. I blame the politicians for not offering leadership and not offering any challenge. And rather than actually any radicalism, back to a point I said earlier on, you need to give people a sense that something is possible beyond what they have now. That another world is possible, as we say. But you know, use a bit of imagination. Right? What kind of world would we like to see? What kind of Scotland would you like to see? What kind of Clydebank would you like to see? What kind of Glasgow would you like to see? Right. That's the holy grail. That's what we're after. Right. Here's A, here's B, how do we get there? And then work out a plan to do it, right? And it won't happen overnight. You know, you have that conversation before, but this is the plan. And we work our way through it. There's no sense of that whatsoever. You know, you have the glamorous bit, if you like, the vision. of the future, and you have the boring bit where, yeah, we work our way through the plans, but you have those things. Those are both important. Whereas at the moment, we have nothing. It's just bouncing to one thing to another, just reacting to this or that, and trying to get through the next election. Or, you know, I think people will fancy a council tax freeze. Ah, that's great. In fact, it'll destroy local services. Ah, fuck it, it doesn't matter. We'll deal with that down the road. And that is the attitude. A 10-year council tax freeze cost local services in Scotland £3 billion. Right? Now, but they did it because they know people will vote for a council tax freeze. And all the parties are guilty of this, by the way. You know, Labour is guilty of this as SNP, right? And rather than saying, rather than having a conversation with folk, like, this is what we want, right? How do we get here? How do we raise the money to do it? Right? Yeah. Actually having an honest conversation. The point is, these conversations aren't even occurring. A workers' parliament, actually, you wouldn't even need to set up the conversation because those visions and those ideas would already be there. The workers were already there, but they're not. What we've got, sadly, is a cohort of management.
Aye, I mean,
whose vision doesn't go beyond the end of their nose, you know.
Aye, I mean, we're referencing back to Mick and everything, and he's got his bust overlooking, like you says, that circus essentially of what's going on in Holyrood. His ashes obviously were secretly secretly placed at the foundation. So, you know, it's for me with this unveiling, and maybe it's me being quite pessimistic and cynical myself, but you know, it's almost like this big humiliation ritual for him. You know what I mean? Let's stick this guy whose chanting slogan was we're a movement, not a monument, is now trapped as a monument.
He's trapped in a monument to managerialism. I mean, it's cruel. It's cruel, and it's not. It's by no means fair. But we can still do something about it. That's the point, right?
Aye.
The way I put it in my wee piece was that, you know, his ashes are sort of waiting there. I mean, if you can reignite ashes, I don't know how that works. But you know, they're waiting there. We need a spark in that parliament, and there is not. Right. I mean, there are some individuals in there who I like and admire and, you know, and I would support. But there's not anything getting things going. There's no cohort, and it needs more than one or two decent individuals in there to give things a shake, to give, you know, to provide a wee spark that might just fire the imagination of the people out there and get them involved in their parliament. Because it is our parliament. It doesn't belong to the managers. It doesn't belong to the entire class of political briefcases that run it now. It belongs to us, and it's a bit like this discussion we had earlier on about trade unions. They belong to us. They don't belong to that to the kind of class of briefcases that run. That's too often run them at times now, right? They belong to the members, and the parliament belongs to the people. And I think if Mick was there right now, it does make me laugh slightly because I just on my wee article, I posted it up on my Facebook, right? And there's a couple of people commenting it. The first person to comment on it was a guy called Michael Kelly. Now, you look him up, he used to be Provost of Glasgow in the 80s, right? Came up with the Glasgow's Miles Better thing, right? Not exactly a lefty, but he just said, good man, on Mick McGarkey. Second up, I swear to God, you can check this. Brian Wilson, who was an MP down in Cunningham North, right? He's now a journalist, but he had been a Labour MP in the 90s. Again, not a wild lefty. I mean, not quite a playwright either, but he's not on the left, right? And he came up and talked about what a great man he was as well. And I just thought, aye, but if somebody like Mick came up today, you guys would be the first to shoot him down. And this is sort of there's a wee issue here. It's a bit like when Tony Benn was talked about as a national treasure or treasurer towards the end of his life, right? They were doing that because he's no longer a threat. Now, sadly, you know, in person anyway, Mick is no longer a threat to the establishment. But I tell you what, his ideas, his vision, his way of life is still a threat to the movement that he was part of and grew to lead. That's still a threat to the establishment. And so that, I think if we want to do something really in mixed memory, then that's what we need to rebuild. And that's how we get that spark in that parliament, and that's how we realise his vision.
Aye, spot on. I think you're hit the nail right in the head there, Matt. And I guess just to kind of bring us round and finish us off then, just to see if you've got any kind of final talking points on Mick or anything else, and you know, whereabouts can we find you on social media and everything else in between?
You can find me in social media. Well, let me think. I think I'm underscore Matt underscore Kerr on Twitter. I think I'm Matt Kerr Socialist on Instagram or something. I'm floating a bit on there anyway. And I'm obviously I write in the Morning Star. So that's where you get most of my ramblings these days. But I've got a column in there every fortnight. So, I think if there's a lesson to be drawn from Mick, is don't get involved in this movement to be Mick McGaughey. Don't get involved in this movement to become the next big guy that'll get a bust made of him. Don't do that. Remember what you are. You're a product of your class. You're a product of your movement. Understand that even just as a union member, even as somebody who's active in a community, you are a leader. We are all leaders in our respective communities. Take that responsibility and that duty seriously. Take your activism in your community into your workplace, and from your workplace into your community. Join the dots. These are the same things. And take them from your community and your workplace out into the world, because that's how we change the world. That's how we make it a place worth living in. And that's ultimately how we'll build a socialism that can stand the test of time. So when I look at that Buster Mick McGaughey, he's a man I seriously admire and always will. But I look at him and I think, he's one of us. He's working class. He was proud of what he was. He was proud of the platform he stood on. And he achieved a great deal with it. And that's the inspiration. That's the inspiration. That's what it's all about. We stand together. We achieve things by standing together as a working class. It's the only way we ever bloody have. We don't achieve things necessarily by being the big man in the paper, by being the big man in the bust, by being the big man in a telly interview or whatever it is, or leading a strike, because all of us in a strike are the leaders. All of us have to stand together to make that happen. Strikes aren't won by general secretaries, they're won by workers. And strong trade unions will be built by the workers, not the general secretaries, or indeed anyone else. I won't just pick in the poopy general secretaries. So whatever the thing is, right, get involved. Join your union. If there's no union in your workplace, join one anyway, build one. That's your responsibility. If you get the agency, if you understand that something else is possible, then you don't just have, it's not enough just to listen to the wee podcast or to tweet about it now and again. You have to do something about it. If you know that, if you know a better world's possible, it's your job to get out there and try and build it. I'll leave it at that.
No, well said, Matt. Good to kind of round off into, you know, Mick's philosophy of bringing it all back to the workplace. So I really appreciate that, and really appreciate you taking the time for your hectic Morning Star schedule and everything else to come on.
No problem at all. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, comrades, for tuning in to another episode of Spectre. As always, be sure to leave us a like and review on whatever platform you're tuning in from. As always, be sure to share us with your friends, co-workers, comrades, and everyone else in between. Marxism and Marxism-Leninism was crucial to McGaughey's worldview. They were also crucial to his work in the NUM, its politics, its action, and demonstrated the influence of historical materialism on day-to-day work. McGaughey stands as a pillar to what socialists, communists, and trade unionists should be at the heart of their community and at the heart of the workplace. Britain's trade unions have regressed into this insurance model that me and Matt talked about. They've reduced militancy, they've reduced radicalism, and they've reduced political education, which was crucial to the NUM's work. If we're going to be serious about fighting for our class and our workplaces, communities, and everywhere else in between, then political education has to be at the forefront of our work, directly starting from the workplaces. Mick saw this, it's what he stood for, and it's up to us to carry that torch forward now and spark the flame of class consciousness in our workplaces. There's a number of memorials dedicated to Mick McGahey in Cambus Lang, in Bonnybrigg, and even as we mentioned in Holyrood. But the reality is, no monument can contain Mick McGahey. His ideals and spirit live on beyond the stone, beyond the cement, and beyond any bust that dared challenge to hold his figure. It's up for us now to take that fight, to take that spirit, and use it against our class enemies. Those in the political establishment, the state, and even those who attempt to infiltrate our trade union movement. So let's take Mick's words. We are a movement, not a monument. And this movement is ready to crush all those who stand in the way of the workers.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
My daddy was a miner and I'm a miner's son. And I'll stick with the union till every battle's won.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Oh, workers, can you stand it? Oh, tell me how you can. Will you be a lousy scab or will you be a man?
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Don't scab for the bosses. Don't listen to their lies. Us poor folks haven't got a chance unless we organize.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side?